Hello and welcome to another episode of What Ed Hess Said. And as always, I am your creepy little host, Eddie. And tonight, we have something a little different, so to speak. Because tonight, I'm going to be reading you a spooky story. Now, to get the most out of this experience, I would recommend that you turn the lights off and you cower under your blankets. But if you can't, you know, that's completely understandable. Just know that it could be a lot better than it is right now. Tonight, I'm going to be reading to you a story called Slum, written by one Nikki Exposito. So get comfortable, because this story is a bit of a mind trip. It'll leave you asking a lot of questions, and by the end of it, it'll leave you asking even more questions. So I highly recommend that you pay attention. Now, without further ado, let's get on with the story. My first job was at a 24-hour restaurant called Flavie's on 3rd and Burlington in Westlake. It was a real hole-in-the-wall place, the type where patrons line up beneath the menu board, specializing in burgers, gyros, and all-day grease-heavy breakfast. I worked graveyard shifts, so did most of my customers. The medical crowd, there were two middle-sized hospitals nearby, cops, firefighters, and the assorted civil servants that filtered in and out of the neighborhood. A middle-aged LAPD officer used to come by sometimes with a partner, sometimes alone. Let's call him Officer Carlos Nunez. Officer Nunez didn't look like a cop. If I'd seen him at the grocery store, I'd have thought he were a professor, or an attorney, or a realtor. He had a square jaw and high forehead, curly brown hair, an endearing bald spot, and the friendly diplomatic face of a sitcom dad. Officer Nunez had stories. On lazy nights, he could entertain his audience for hours. That audience consisting of Eagle Scout-looking fire babies, bored security guards, and nursing students off clinical shifts. 30 years with a badge and a car had given him plenty of material. When there were no kiddies to impress, he talked to me. Some of the stories were pretty dark. He saved those stories for the coldest, windiest nights when Flavie's was empty, save for him and me, and the cooks. Though it was nearly a decade ago, what he told me on those nights still lingers in the back of my mind. "There's a building," he would start, "less than a mile from here near 6th and Alvarado. It was abandoned, repossessed by the bank. They should have bulldozed that dump." It had been low-income housing, the Primrose Apartments, originally office space. The building was bought at auction in 1999, gutted and divided into cheap little white-walled units where the roofs leaked and the air conditioning never worked. In the early 2000s, Nunez was dispatched to the Primrose every couple of weeks for the reasons one would expect: domestic disturbances, possessions with intent to sell, drunken brawls in the parking lot, solicitation, truancy, noise complaints, nothing out of the ordinary for a public housing complex lodged within the bowels of a major city. Yet, somehow, embarrassingly, the building played on his nerves. "Yeah, I never liked the place," he told me. "It was creepy. No building erected in the 70s has the right to be as creepy as that one." If he had been asked to put a finger on the epicenter of this innate creepiness, he'd have pointed to a little closet on the first floor. The way he described it was coming from the back entrance, which only employees and cops ever used. A left turn would take you to a set of double doors, through which the elevator lobby and the leasing office were accessible. A right turn led down a narrow hallway past the janitor's storage to a dead end. One night, Nunez and his partner, a lady cop, who went by Rusty, were dispatched in to Primrose to investigate a domestic disturbance. A man threatening his girlfriend with a butcher knife. They found the woman locked in the bathroom and a boyfriend pounding on the door. Let's call the woman Marisol and the man Modesto. Nunez and Rusty managed to cajole the pair into cooperating. Rusty stayed in the bathroom with Marisol. Nunez sat in the kitchen with Modesto. Modesto claimed that Marisol was cheating on him with her ex-husband. He'd seen the ex hanging around the elevator lobby. When quizzed on the subject, Marisol insisted Modesto was crazy. Yes, she was still friendly with her ex-husband, but it was solely for the sake of their son. She had no desire to sleep with him, and besides, the ex-husband lived in Washington. It was suggested that Modesto had seen a man who resembled Marisol's ex. He got defensive. He strode into Marisol's son's room and came out with a framed picture. The son, with his arm around a taller, better-looking man. "I gotta see this stuff every day," he ranted to Nunez. "You don't think I'd recognize this guy if I saw him?" It took a while, but Modesto calmed down and admitted he may have been mistaken. Marisol didn't want to press charges, and the couple was left in peace. 2 weeks later, Nunez and Rusty were called to the same apartment for the same reason. This time, Marisol was barricaded in the master bedroom, and Modesto was brandishing a tire iron, insisting he'd had an enraging conversation with her ex-husband in the lobby. "You screwed him," he screamed. "He told me you screwed him on our bed." Backup was called 30 minutes later. Modesto was cuffed, sobbing to a chair, while Marisol tearfully paced on the phone with the ex-husband, trying to prove he hadn't been hanging out in the lobby of the Primrose. "There," she cried finally. Triumphantly, she pulled up a picture on her phone and shoved it in Modesto's face. She handed the phone to Nunez. It was of the man from the picture. Her ex-husband, standing by a City of Wenatchee street sign, holding a copy of the Wenatchee World with the day's date. "No way he flew here, screwed me, and flew back to Washington in time to take that picture." Modesto was asked to elaborate. Maybe he was the butt of a cruel trick. He said he'd been alone in the elevator lobby checking his mail. The ex-husband stealthily came up beside him and had described in graphic, excruciating detail what he and Marisol have done while Modesto was at work. This time, Modesto was more difficult to pacify. He'd been suspicious for months. He told the cops he knew the ex-husband had attempted to reconcile with Marisol. He was uncomfortable with their amicable relationship, and it didn't help that Marisol used her ex to stroke Modesto's jealousy. She'd call him whenever the two of them got into a fight and constantly talked about how good of a father and provider he was. Finally, they came to a resolution. Modesto went to stay with his brother. Marisol agreed to lock the doors, and a police car was dispatched to the neighborhood in case the ex-husband appeared, or Modesto got cute. Nunez didn't know what to make of the two of them. Modesto was obviously paranoid, but his fury and grief had been sincere. Marisol may have used her ex-husband to make her current beau jealous, but she'd seemed legitimately mystified by his accusations of infidelity, and Nunez highly doubted the ex-husband would have hopped on a plane to Los Angeles just to screw his ex-wife and stick it to her new boyfriend. And then there was the man in the elevator lobby. The man who might have been in the elevator lobby. Nunez and Rusty passed him on the way back to their squad car, a man leaning against the wall, face buried in a newspaper. Nunez saw the man and registered what he was seeing, but it took his subconscious a minute to process the information. Then, realization of what he'd seen and its implications hit him like a ton of bricks. And he'd run back through the back entrance, back through the double doors, but the man was gone. And Nunez was left to wonder whether or not it had been his imagination. Because he could swear the man had been reading a copy of the Wenatchee World. Detailed an incident involving a middle-aged Bible thumper he called Dolores. Dolores lived on the second floor of the Primrose Apartments. She was a sweet lady, but painfully high-strung. At least once a week, the cops were summoned to her humble abode. She heard a noise after midnight? Call the cops. Two suspicious-looking men talking in the parking lot? Call the cops. Her son's out 5 minutes past curfew? Call the cops. It had gotten to the point where the dispatchers recognized her voice. Nunez had been sent down to calm her down more than once. He believed that truly Dolores just needed someone to talk to. And she talked a lot. She talked about her blackout, drunk past, about her husband who had fled in the dead of night with the shoebox full of cash she'd been saving for her kids to go to college, never to be seen or heard from again. She told about how she'd found Jesus and how she wished her meth-addicted daughter would come home. The daughter had been in Bakersfield, last she heard, shacking up with the boyfriend du jour and 3 months pregnant. But that had been 2 years ago, and now her number was disconnected and her mail got sent back, and all Dolores could do was pray for her grandchild. She talked about her son, Michael. He was 17 and a senior in high school. Michael was a good boy, she insisted, but she didn't like his friends. They were a bad influence on him, and lately he'd been avoiding her calls and coming home late. He was surlier, angrier, and his clothes smelled like marijuana. He swore the pot smell had come from his friend's car, but Dolores was scared. She thought he was doing drugs. "I can't lose him," she'd sobbed to Nunez as he tried to convince her that the car stalling in the parking lot wasn't indicative of a drug deal. "Mikey is all I have left." One September day, Nunez and Rusty were yet again dispatched to Dolores' apartment. He was more frustrated than concerned. They'd have a rough morning, and he wasn't in the mood to take notes on the explosion. Red, upstairs neighbor, dropped a pot and lid. Dolores is hurt, or not, and through one of her long-winded tales of motherly woe. But according to the dispatcher, this time was different. Dolores, who usually took an assertive and condescending tone, had been screaming and crying. It was her son. He was hurt. The paramedics were 15 minutes away. Dolores answered the door, howling. Her prematurely wrinkled face was streaked with tears. Her eyes were bloodshot. Her hair stuck out where she pulled it, and she was sobbing so violently she could barely speak. "Michael," she panted, pointing towards the door. "Michael, he's... She screamed, primal animalistic. She cried out to the sky and collapsed on the floor, burying her tear-stained face in her knees. Even thinking about it, Nunez told me, was enough to make him tear up. All the pain and despair in the world was captured in that scream. Rusty tried to comfort Dolores. Nunez, hand on his gun, opened the door. The smell hit him immediately. Musty, like a basement after a rainstorm, mixed with something sweeter. The poopery his mother had kept in a bowl. He breathed through his mouth. He flipped the light switch. A teenage boy's room in the far corner, a mattress with bedding kicked aside. On the mattress, a young man no older than 18 was propped up against the wall. His head hung low, jaundiced, blue eyes still open, skinny, anorexic, purple blood pooling under waxen skin, stringy red hair, blotched, infected track marks, oozing pus, joints stiff and contracted, swollen tongue lolling. Nunez buckled. He might have cried out. Trembling like a dog, he knelt by the boy. Given the dullness of the sunken cheeks and the violet hue of the flaccid limbs, he hypothesized the kid had been dead for hours, if not a day. Overdose. Slipping on a pair of latex gloves, holding his breath, he reached for the corpse's face. The glassy doll's eyes were too much to bear. If he closed them, his head would stop spinning and his hands would stop shaking and he could function like an officer of the law as opposed to a squeamish little... A hand clasped his arm. An icy, vice-strong claw grasped his arm. It took him a twisting, maddening second to realize what was happening. Michael's cold dead, decomposing Michael's cyanotic fingers were wrapped around his wrist. Nunez fell backwards. Michael sat up straight, folded, turned his torso. His stiff, angular joints jerked mechanically, grotesquely. His tarnished plastic eyes stared lifelessly ahead. Then the jaw moved, jostling the swollen, languid tongue, and with no respect for mechanics or anatomy, he spoke. "Officer Nunez." A monotone, alien mockery of a human voice. "This will all burn. You will burn with it." Nunez grunted, kicked, tugged, broke free of the creature's grip. He twisted onto his hands and knees. He stumbled to the door, turned the knob, and fell into the living room, slamming the door behind him. Dolores was curled on the couch, sobbing quietly. Rusty stood on the doorway, waving to the paramedics who were making their way down the hallway with their gurney.
"The boy, he's not," Nunez stammered.
Rusty turned to him, then snapped her head back towards the hallway.
"What the hell?"
A paramedic pushed past her into the apartment. On his heels was a teenage boy with longish red hair and blue eyes, dressed in khakis and a NWA sweater. Looking quite confused, it was Michael. Michael, very much alive. Dolores screamed. In one movement, she threw herself onto her son, collapsing with him to the dirty shag carpet, clutching him in a suffocating embrace. Rusty gave Nunez a look. The paramedic rolled his eyes. "Dying boy found walking upstairs to his mother's apartment," he said sarcastically. "Please tell me he's got an identical twin." It was a miracle Nunez held onto his stuff. Looking at Michael, healthy, breathing Michael cradled in his mother's arms, he had never been so scared of a human being in his entire life. "There's a corpse," he managed to force out, eager to establish some context to the zombie movie jump scare he'd just experienced. Nunez grasped the doorknob with his right hand to pull himself up. Searing pain tore down his arm. He fell to his knees, groaning. The paramedic pushed past him, opened the door, looked in, and snorted. "There's nothing here." Nunez managed to rise to his feet. He and Rusty peered into Michael's room. There was nothing. The mattress, save a bunch of comforter and sheets, was unoccupied. No blood, no excrements, just an empty teenager's bedroom. He did a lap of the room just to make sure. He shook out the comforter, dug through a hamper of dirty clothes, threw open the closet door. Nothing. No remnants of the atrophied, decomposing corpse that had threatened Nunez with fire. He sniffed the air. The musty, poopery smell still hung in the air, but it was fainter now, dissipated despite the tightly closed window. Dolores, giddily happy, concluded she must have imagined seeing her son's dead body. She didn't do any drugs, no sir, clean for 12 years, but had been under a lot of psychological stress and lay awake nights haunted by visions of her only remaining child repeating her youthful mistakes. That, with the heat and the smog, it was enough to make anyone hallucinate.
"I saw the same thing she did," Nunez remembered saying. "Michael sprawled dead on the mattress."
At that, Dolores had frowned.
"What are you talking about, sprawled? I found him hanging in this closet."
Nunez couldn't get out of there fast enough. "It was weird," Rusty said, "but not completely inconceivable." Dolores was delusional. Nunez had been overly susceptible to the power of suggestion, and had imagined seeing a corpse because Dolores said there was a corpse. Induced psychotic disorder.
"I don't know," she told him. "If you're really seeing things, maybe you should take some time off. Go see the department shrink."
Nunez had passed on the shrink. No use having someone else tell him he was crazy. But as it turned out, the time off was involuntary. He woke up next morning with his right wrist ballooning. Dislocation. Fracture.
"I must have fallen on it," he lied.
No attention was paid to the 5 purple bruises around his wrist. So much like the Prince of 5 strong, clutching fingers. Nunez told his final tragic tale of the Primrose Apartments as though it had been a dream. Testimony knotted together with conjecture and hearsay. He was on medical leave for 2 months while his arm healed. When he returned to the station, he was greeted with whispers and pitying stares. Rusty, bless her heart, had stood up for him, telling their superiors the incident with Michael and Dolores was a non-issue, a side effect of overwork. But he guessed the paramedic team had told everyone he was losing it. Luckily for him, he wasn't the only guy on the force rubbed the wrong way by the Primrose Apartments. In fact, even the tenants of the Primrose Apartments seemed put off by the place. According to Officer Arunan, a desk cop that knew everything about everyone, families were jumping ship like rats before a storm. "They can't keep it filled," he'd said to Nunez over the water cooler. "They're at about half capacity now, and that's with subsidies from the county. No one can stay there for long, save the junkies who've already fried their brains. There's a rumor the building's haunted." Others sought him out as well, usually in secluded spaces, always requiring him multiple assurances that
As far as Tap Brass was concerned, the conversation did not happen. They'd been to the Primrose Apartments. They'd seen stuff. "It's always the users and the drunks," Officer Ennis murmured excitedly. "Always the same thing. They call us flippin' stuff because they see some dead family member in the kitchen, or the frickin' elevator, or staring down at them from the ceiling. If it were one, I wouldn't be too worried. But it's one every week, always at the godforsaken dump." "I think I'm going crazy," Officer Liu told him late one night, after everyone else had left. "Some old lady called us down there because she was convinced her neighbor was stealing from her. Total BS. We found her missing antique vase in the closet. Right where she'd hid it from the nurse, who she also thought was stealing. You know the type. Anyways, I finished up with her and my partner said she was going to the car. But when I stepped out into the hallway, she was waiting there. We took the elevator down. On the first floor, I stepped out. She didn't follow me. I looked back and she wasn't in the elevator at all. She just disappeared. This chill came over me and I ran like a rabbit. I ran back to the car and guess who I found sitting shotgun, talking on the phone to dispatch? My partner. I asked her how she got there so fast. She looked at me weird. She said she'd never gone back into the building. Dispatch had requested a landline. She'd been in the car the whole time, talking. If you don't mind me asking, Nunez said, what did the two of you talk about on the elevator? That's the thing, Officer Liu replied. On the elevator, she asked me what I thought the point of life was. We're never really fulfilled or satisfied, and then we die. It's like we never existed. It's the most depressing conversation I've ever had. I swear it messed me up for weeks, and I noticed this weird smell. Like a wet basement mixed with poopery? Yeah, Officer Liu said. I'd say weed and mold, but that works too. Then Nunez learned about little Thaddeus Wheeler. Thad was 12 years old. He lived on the fourth floor of the Primrose Apartments with his mom, two little brothers, half-sister, and niece. Sad story. His mother worked as a CNA at a St. Vincent Knights. Thad's father had been in the ground for 3 years, shot in the driveway of the house where the family had once lived. Likely the victim of a gang initiation. There were photos of him with the kids all over the apartment. Little Thad had been a good student, a good kid, a talented artist, talented enough to make a difference. Had been. Lately, his teacher had reported that Thad was falling asleep in class and falling behind on his work. He ignored his friends and family. While his brothers played video games or rode bikes in the parking lot, Thad would lock himself in the room. His drawings, once of animals and fantasy creatures, had become much darker, scary things with sharp claws and teeth. Once, a month before, Lydia Wheeler, the mother, called 911 in a panic. When she'd arrived home at 5:30, Thad was missing. Three sets of cops were dispatched to search the premises. They found the boy, an hour later, fast asleep in a little closet. Right across from the janitor's closet? Nunez asked, dreading the answer. Yeah, the other officer said, frowning. How'd you know? When asked why he did it, Thad responded that he simply liked it there. Sleepwalking, everyone thought. But the police had been called to Lydia Wheeler's apartment twice more since then. Once by Lydia because Thad was hitting his head against the wall and wouldn't stop. And once by a neighbor because Thad was wandering aimlessly through the halls, clutching a serrated steak knife. Lydia had told the cops that Thad's nighttime sojourns to the little closet on the first floor had become a recurring incident. Three times a week, she would find him there, asleep, on the dirty linoleum floor. She was looking for a therapist. The next time Thaddeus Wheeler inspired a 911 call by the sister Rochelle, this time, Nunez and Rusty were the one of the two pairs sent. 12-year-old African-American male, the dispatcher had said, locked in a bedroom, armed with a knife, possibly a second person with him. Nunez and Rusty met Rochelle, a chubby girl of about 19, in the hallway outside of the apartment, a toddler and two school-aged boys huddled at her feet. "There's a man in there," Rochelle cried. "I went to the door to call Thad for dinner and I heard him talking to someone. This deep, man's voice responded. Then Thad started screaming, "No, no, no," and something slammed against the wall. I tried to force the door, but it's locked, and I think there's something pushed against it.
"Did you hear what the man said to Thad?" Rusty asked calmly.
Rochelle shook her head. "I think I'm going crazy. I couldn't make out what he said, but it sounded like... I don't know, it's BS.
"What?"
Rusty asked. "I thought he sounded like my stepfather. But my stepfather's been dead for years."
Rusty herded Rochelle and the children towards the elevator. Guns drawn, Nunez and the other two officers entered the apartment. From one of the rooms, they heard a child crying. Coming up on the closed door, Nunez and the second cop positioned themselves. The burliest of the three turned his shoulder, took a running start, and rammed the door. Bang! The door slid open. A nightstand had been placed against it. Nunez nearly dropped his gun in shock. The must and poopery smell hit him in the face like a wave. Little Thad sat on the floor between two sets of bunk beds, clad in a wife beater and boxer shorts, holding a steak knife. Up and down his arms and legs were deep, jagged, self-inflicted cuts. His face was swollen and snotty. Upon seeing the two guns pointed at him, he dropped the knife and let out a small cry. "We're not gonna hurt you, kid," Nunez heard himself say. The room was completely trashed. There were pictures on the walls, horrible demons, mutilated humans and animals, flames, torture implements. Upon further inspection, the drawings were determined to have been completed with both marker and Thad's blood. The paramedics and the Department of Mental Health were called. The apartment was thoroughly searched for the esoteric second party, the man with the deep voice. No one was found. Nunez and Rusty approached little Thad as he sat, shivering on a gurney, the paramedic bandaging his arms.
"Hey, buddy," Nunez said amicably. "I'm Officer Carlos. Do you mind if we ask you a few questions?"
Thad shrugged.
"Okay. Your sister told us she heard you talking to someone in your room. Can you tell us who?"
Thad stared.
"You're not gonna get them in trouble, buddy. We just want to talk to them. Make sure they're okay. We're not gonna arrest them or anything."
"You can't arrest him," Thad said. "He's not human."
"Oh?" Nunez responded. "Is he a ghost?"
"He's my dad. He's dead. He died and the angel sent him to hell. He comes and sees me at night and tells me what to do so me and my family don't have to go to hell with him when we die."
"Oh. What does he tell you to do?"
Thad shook his head. "He says I have to draw demons every day, and whenever I have a bad thought, I have to hurt myself."
The DMH lady came back, handing a 5585 detainment form to the paramedics. The paramedics lifted the gurney into the ambulance. Rusty stayed back to talk to them. Nunez, brain buzzing, went to start his report. The druggies see their dead family members. That's what Officer Anderson had said. Officer Liu had spoken to his partner while his partner was in the squad car talking to dispatch. He'd seen Michael's corpse reanimate and assault him. Dolores had seen Michael's corpse hanging in the closet. Michael was alive. Modesto had seen Marisol's ex-husband. The ex-husband was in Washington. Rochelle had heard Thad's father's voice. Thad said his dead father came and visited him. What the heck was going on in that apartment building?